So it's never easy to follow Gretchen, to talk about goals of care, but I hopefully will build on what Herb presented and what Gretchen presented in the context of the surgical ICU, and we'll hopefully all come together. If I can figure out how to move the slides. I have no disclosures. So palliative care in the ICU has really evolved, and 15 years ago when I stood up in this organization, we were really talking about how to manage death in the ICU and things like futility and how would we take care of patients and do better end-of-life care. And in fact, 15, 20 years ago, a significant majority of Americans died in the ICU. And we thought with the palliative care movement that things would get better. And in fact, we now, this is data on Medicare recipients, and you can see in 2009 that the percent of deaths who died in hospice has dramatically increased to over 40%. But we continue to have people dying in the ICU and in the hospital despite that. And in fact, what we've really done is even though we have more people going to hospice before they die, we continue to have people spending significant amounts of time, almost a third, in the ICU in the months before they die. So we still need to manage these patients and do really good end-of-life care and palliative care as best we can. The truth is that when patients now die in the ICU, the vast majority, 80, 90%, in pretty much all of our American ICUs, die with withdrawal withholding of life support for the most part. But it's often just a day or two at the most before they die. So the reality of American medicine is that we continue, at least among the elderly, at least 30% will spend time in the ICU before they die. And as we know from multiple studies now, at least a third will have surgery in the last year of life as well. So we are all taking care of patients, and we need to know how to do this better. It turns out that in the last 10 or 15 years, many of the things that were very mortal, we've gotten better at it, and people are surviving more. So the mortality rate for ARDS has improved. So we have more patients who are surviving very long ICU stays. And the mortality with severe sepsis in many places has also improved. So we have patients who are surviving some of the things that are very common in surgical ICU patients. And in fact, caring for survivors of critical illness is really the new palliative care issue. And we are now coming to understand the post-ICU syndrome or chronic critical illness has many, many sequelae that some of which are permanent, like cognitive dysfunction, delirium, significant functional problems. And so palliative care in the ICU is not just about dying anymore. It is about doing really good end-of-life care, but it's also about taking care of patients while they're in the ICU and taking care of them after and addressing their survivorship as well. So part of our challenge has been we don't really know the outcomes very well, and we're starting to get more and more of this data. This is a study by Gretchen's group that I think is really tells a story that we haven't really thought about, that even though we can get people to survive the ICU, this is particularly the elderly, many of them who've had a long ventilator course will go on and have a significant one-year mortality. Most of them will not be alive at the end of the year. So we don't think about this. So palliative care in the surgical ICU is really about giving the right care for the right patient at the right time. And Herb already put up this great picture, which is still really true. So it's not really either or. Should we be doing surgical care and ICU care and then do palliative care? It's really doing both at the same time. So we need to be skilled at delivering palliative care alongside surgical care. So this whole session is about early palliative care integration. And there is increasing data, and I think you'll hear more about cancer patients where there's frankly a lot of data that early palliative care makes a huge difference. One of those huge differences is that patients with cancer who get early palliative care in parallel to their curative treatment of, are less likely to use the ICU at the end of life. And hopefully she'll talk more about that. So what does it do? It aligns care with patients' values, goals, and preferences. It improves symptom management. It avoids the burdens of treatment, which whether they're surgery, chemo, or whatever. And it also improves the quality of life for survivors, and I think we're going to see more and more of that. But it's hard. It's hard to figure out who needs it. How do we know? We all deal with prognostic uncertainty, and a really great discussion, at least with trauma patients, about those calculators. And there are many calculators that help us with prognosis. But that's, as you've heard, is not the whole story. We have to make decisions. We have to engage the patient or family and help them navigate the uncertainty. And we have to navigate all that uncertainty with communication. And that's the goals of care discussion. So we've done some work both at my place and nationally when we just came out with guidelines for palliative care and trauma patients from the Committee on Trauma. And the first thing that we strongly recommend is that there be some kind of palliative care assessment within 24 hours for every adult patient who is in the ICU. And that includes a prognostic assessment with whatever tool you find valuable, and with the elderly, some kind of frailty assessment. There needs to be a family assessment, and you should identify a healthcare proxy immediately because things happen, as we all know. People get intubated, they crash, and all of a sudden we don't know who to talk to. And identify if there's an advanced directive and assess the patient for what their ongoing needs may be. And this is very simple, and it sounds great, but it's amazing that most of us don't do this within 24 hours. So what is the screen for early palliative care? It is essentially based on identifying the patients who will benefit from a goals of care discussion, and it's mostly based on the prognostication assessment. Prognostication assessment is not only based on the disease process or the injury. It's what other comorbidities do they have? Do they have end-stage heart failure? It's not just age, it's frailty. And we need to give a prognosis not just for survival, which is obviously very important, but for many elderly in particular, the prognosis for functional outcome and quality of life is as important, if not more important, and we need to be able to prognosticate for long-term outcomes. So one good way to do this is the surprise question, which we were just in the other session, and somebody referred to that. So what's the surprise question? The surprise question is, would you be surprised if the patient died within 6 months to a year? And if the answer is no, I wouldn't be surprised, that person is basically meets criteria for hospice, which is a six-month prognosis. So if you ask this question, and there are now several studies, this is actually a systematic review of using the surprise question with multiple kinds of patients. If the nurses or the physicians say they're not surprised, it's a pretty good prognosticator. So you don't need scores. You just need kind of a gestalt. And Zora Cooper's group did a study on this in emergency surgical conditions and, again, found that if the answer was no, the odds ratio for death was almost five times those that it was a yes. So shared decision-making, and you've heard a lot about this from Gretchen, really requires a goals of care discussion. And you can't share if you're not communicating with each other, being the physician and the patient or family. And the role of the physician is to elicit the goals and preferences of the patient and discuss the prognosis in context for meaningful outcomes. Might not just be death. Might be I need to be alive to go to my granddaughter's wedding in a month. So in our place, we've developed a communication bundle that we still use. We did this originally in trauma patients, but we actually applied it to all of our ICU patients. And it is essentially what I just described, which is some kind of assessment of prognosis, pain, and symptoms on admission within 24 hours and providing support to the family. And within 72 hours, having a family meeting. to discuss goals of care. We initially did this on every single adult patient because we felt there was so much uncertainty about who was going to die or not die that we just did it early. There's a lot of data, not necessarily in surgical ICUs, but in medical ICUs, that having a goals of care discussion within 72 hours is really beneficial. It avoids non-beneficial life support for people who ultimately die. It decreases the length of stay. It really moves the process of lingering up, so patients have a much shorter time in that lingering death phase in multiple organ failure. And we indeed found the same thing, that it does decrease non-beneficial life support and length of stay, both for survivors and for patients who died. Improves family satisfaction with communication. We found no change in mortality rate, which is always something I get asked, is how, well, you're making more people die, which is not true. So we did this in trauma patients, general surgery patients, and transplant patients. So I'll talk a little bit about the family meeting. We've heard really a great discussion about the communication issues. The ideal family meeting in the ICU is really an interdisciplinary process with a physician, preferably either the ICU physician or the surgeon who knows the patient or the family the best, and with members of the family. Most patients in the ICU cannot communicate effectively. And somebody who provides psychosocial support, whether it's nursing or a social worker in your institution, it's really helpful to have multiple colleagues do this. There's a lot of literature, which I don't have time to go through. There's a lot of well-developed communication processes, and high-quality family meetings really include clear communication about prognosis. The most important thing, I think, to take away is the amount of time we spend listening. So we need to assess for understanding, ask a lot of questions, and then respond to emotion. And that's the part that we most frequently miss, is we're so busy giving information about prognosis that we fail to appreciate what the family truly understands, and we fail to acknowledge their emotion, as Gretchen just described. I think there's challenges with surrogate decision makers don't understand their role, and that needs to be clarified. And we have to really show compassion and care. So that's the best practice, I think, in a nutshell, which is a whole other presentation. But I think our role is to communicate prognosis in an effective way, avoid statistics. People don't really understand the true sense of risk if you give them statistics. You have to put it into a context and tell a story. Ask questions and listen. Empathic statements are really helpful. So it's a series of that. There are a number of prognostic tools. This is another one, which is e-prognosis, and I won't go into that. So this is not necessarily easy. We all need training in it, but it can be done, and even surgeons can communicate very effectively. We tend to focus on statistics when we should really focus on emotions, name them, explore them, and assess for understanding. Patients and families really want to know about the outcomes and how they will affect their life and their quality of life in the future. And many of our treatments, as we know, have burdens. So ask questions. What does better look like to you? What is most important to you? Have you ever thought about your wishes if you could not speak for yourself? Those kind of questions. I talked about clarifying the role of the surrogate. It's always, if there's not clarity on one outcome or prognosis or whether how things will go, you can try time-limited trials. And any therapy can be withheld or withdrawn even once it's started. So you can have a trial of intubation, a trial of ventilator, a trial of surgery. Always assure the patient that whatever decision they make, that you will continue to care for them and not be abandoned. Essentially, I think of the family meeting as a way to manage uncertainty, and I think the best case, worst case scenario is a really good way to do that. I'm running out of time. So I think in summary, the key is really early palliative care, early goals of care discussion. There's very good evidence that moving this upstream, even when there's uncertainty about prognosis, is very, very positive for the family, the patient, and for ourselves, and a good way to begin the communication. And I think those are my conclusions.